Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood in 21 podcast. We are from No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We are covering the Twin Peaks television series.
We are not a spoiler-free podcast. If you haven't seen the show, we would love to have you listen, but don't listen until you catch up or until you've watched the whole series. You have been warned.
If you want to support this podcast, you can visit our website at noship.net, and you can click on our links that will direct you to iTunes to review us. That's actually the best way to support us. You can also click on our Amazon link and you can help support us financially without actually spending any money on us. Actually, like, you'll spend money on the thing you want from Amazon, but Amazon will give us a percentage of that. So a very tiny, tiny, tiny percentage, but
it's still a percentage.
Yes.
Go to Amazon and treat yourself and we get a little bit of money.
Yes.
At no extra cost to you. It's a win-win.
That's right. Also, at our website at noship.net, when you click on our contact page, you can also find out where to write to us. If you have any thoughts on this show or on our podcast, you can write to us and we will read it on our next pod. Okay, so PSA.
For the remainder of the podcast, please stay on the bike.
All right, so now we are discussing Twin Peaks Season 2, Episode 7, Lonely Souls, which was written by Mark Frost and directed by David Lynch. Any thoughts on this episode before we get started?
When it's directed by David Lynch and written by Mark Frost, you can tell. You can really, really tell. This is an awesome episode. It's right up there with anything that was in Season 1.
So this is how it's going to be for 2016. They're going to do both.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Then I have high hopes. I'm really like, I mean, I might be setting myself up for a fall here, but I feel like it's going to be awesome.
I think it will be.
But this episode is really, really good. It's probably in the top three episodes of the whole series, really, but definitely of Season 2. It might be the best episode of Season 2. I might reserve that for the last couple of episodes because there's just so much good stuff that happens there with the whole How's Annie and everything, but I don't know. I'll just cut the crap and say this was a great episode.
So now, episode opens up with a lineup of coffee drinkers at the sheriff's department. Hawk, Gordon Cole, Coop, Mike/Philip, and Andy. Harry comes out saying they are ready to go. Mike is repeating the Great Northern description from the night before. Cooper asks Harry if the guests will be in the lobby. And then Harry responds with yes, there will be full cooperation. And then he asks Hawk if he has the warrant for Harold Smith. Cooper tells Hawk about the secret diary of Laura Palmer. Gordon Cole has to excuse himself to Bend, Oregon. I wrote a note to myself. He needs to go sit next to the director of photography is more like it.
So this is like a who's who of Twin Peaks law enforcement. Actually, even more than Twin Peaks because you got FBI special agents.
Right.
So these are all the good guys lined up against the wall.
And Mike. /Philip.
Yeah.
Not sure if he's really a good guy. He's kind of this ambiguous gray area.
Remember the old, I forgot what show it was on. One of these things is not like the others. It was like a kid's show from the 80s or the 70s.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. Somebody will. Somebody write in and tell me what that's from because I know I'm not making it up.
If you care.
If you care. Anyway. So once again, Hawk has to go do the actual police work while everybody else goes and does whatever the hell it is they're going to go do.
He's like, right on a bus as soon as I finish my coffee.
Yeah. You know, I didn't even clock in yet, right? It's 7:30.
All right, so we're moving on. Now we're at the Great Northern. Mike is assessing guests that are brought before him. He looks overworked.
Well, this seems to be like Philip Gerard, actually, rather than Mike. Because
it
he has
Mike.
It is Mike?
Yeah.
Because he kind of had, well, what about
Philip Gerard seems to be in the dark about everything.
Yeah. But he seems like overly agitated like Philip Gerard gets because when it's Mike, he seems to have a sort of confidence and he's in control. But when it's Philip Gerard, he's like just geeked out, you know.
He's just a weird dude.
Could be, yeah.
He's from the lodge.
But it has to be Mike. You're absolutely right because they say without chemicals, he points.
Right.
Because the haloperidol and whatever else it's mixed with suppresses Mike. So you're absolutely right. Okay, moving on.
Yeah, so he's looking overworked or just, as you said, overstimulated maybe.
Yeah.
There are a lot of cadets throwing balls around, and I think it's maybe a way to make the scene seem even more harrowing in a way.
Heightens the tension because before you know what the actual sound is coming from, it's just this onslaught of it, and you have him in full frame, and he's kind of like looking, yeah, like you said, very harried.
See, it doesn't have that effect on me because it sounds like popcorn popping, and I get happy.
But you're just weird like that, so.
Because I love popcorn. So Ben makes his way towards them. He's stomping through the hallways with his big burning cigar between his lips. Of course, when he gets near Mike, Mike has a meltdown.
So what does this say about
I
Ben
actually,
Horn?
Mike actually made started having a meltdown before he actually got in their room, but I think
It
it
culminated,
coincided. Yeah.
culminated with his appearance, and he
Right.
grabs at his missing arm. So, and Ben, it's noteworthy to say that he's smoking, and he is this directly precedes something stupid that he's going to do,
Yeah.
something crazy and reckless. So.
So at Harold's, orchids and papers are strewn all over the place. I bet a lot of the paper is the stories of people's lives he's collected. And then we see that he's hanged himself.
I think I have in my notes, Harold Bedarrell, there's no manana. Sorry about that, guys,
That's so
but
sad.
it was just a callback to the Donna Madonna, there's always manana.
You're so mean to Harold.
I am, but I don't like it when people commit suicide. It's so final.
So at the Palmers, Leland, Sarah, and Maddie have their morning coffee while Louis Armstrong plays in the background. Maddie announces that she is leaving. They are disappointed, but then Leland becomes very encouraging.
And very understanding too, because Sarah's just like, we understand what? Obviously she's the surrogate for their daughter for more reasons than one, and she doesn't want to see her go because it makes it easier for Sarah to cope with the whole situation because she has a Laura lookalike living in the house who she gets along with. There's not this tension between teenage mother and daughter, but
That scene opens with the painting that Maddie's.
the one that says Missoula, Montana
Yeah,
on
the one
it.
that he slams her head into at the end.
Ugh.
Do you think that when he became encouraging, that it was Bob? Like he saw his opportunity?
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that.
I don't know, though, because at the end, Bob's like, Leland says you're moving back to Missoula, Montana. So I don't know. It's hard to know for sure. So at Harold's, they take down Harold's body, and they, in the process, Cooper finds the note that says in French, "I am a lonely soul," which we heard the little boy from the Tremonts say to Donna.
Oh, I did not. I forgot about that. Interesting.
Hawk finds Laura's diary. A camera flashes. They end the scene with the three of them looking at it, and they have another camera flash on this, and it makes me think of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And the use of lightning as a way of foreshadowing something terrible.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about this particular scene is when they find all that you had mentioned it before, all the papers that are strewn about Harold's floor. It looks like he just tore up a bunch of stuff before he actually killed himself.
Yeah.
Do you think he was doing that to maybe preserve some anonymity on the part of the people who he's talked to, possibly? Maybe there's some incriminating evidence or something like that?
I don't know if there was really much thought, more emotion, but from what how I would imagine the situation is that he was completely enraged because we last saw him.
So he was killing the orchids then.
Maybe because I thought about it more after the fact, after we talked about it, and when you get into these like weird emotions where you'll immediately start doing something physical. Like sometimes if I have a weird thought that is like a really nasty negative feeling when I'm driving my car, for instance, I'll immediately turn my radio up like really loud. It's like I'm trying to drown something out in my head. And I'll be observant of myself doing it suddenly. And I think, maybe him picking up that whatever that thing is, that hydrator as I called
Yeah.
it was probably more something like that. Like he's trying to cleanse or just kind of get the environment back to the optimum environment, because we had talked about the orchid curse and what that
Right.
meant, but then he probably couldn't get that equilibrium back that he
He
was
had
trying
lost
to.
it.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
so I think he probably just
You're,
tore stuff up and.
I think you're right. I'm going to take that back. I don't think he was trying to kill the orchids. I think he was trying to, he was kind of like overreaching to try to get back towards his equilibrium, and that was like his part of his routine and doing things. I understand that feeling you're talking about. Like sometimes when something really bad happens, you feel like there's a physical manifestation of it that
Right.
comes with it. And sometimes when you're almost in denial of what happens, you just kind of your physical reactions go into a routine. I think some people like start doing dishes or start, when they
I
get
do
really bad,
clean.
they get bad news, they start going into routines that have nothing to do and have no effect
Yeah.
on what's happening, but it's kind of like a mental tick or
Yeah.
something. So yeah, that was more likely what he was trying to do rather than what I said.
But it does look like he did a mass suicide, like you're suggesting. So, I mean, either one of us really could be right.
And maybe because the way I looked at all the paper strewn about on the floor was that, like, if I'm going to die, all of these people's secrets are going to die with me.
Or all those people, those are the people he lived with, were those stories he wrote down.
Oh,
So
yeah.
he, in a sense, is killing them along with himself.
So this is like a Jonestown massacre kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, there was Kool-Aid in that hydrator.
So now at the Johnsons, Shelley and Bobby are doing the bills. She only has $42 for the month. Bobby immediately extracts himself from the we department. She says we meant her and Leo. She gives him the necklace he bought for her to take back because they need the money. Bobby begins to talk about all of Leo's side deals he had going. He must have had money. Leo begins to scream and then says, new shoes. When Shelley's saying he is alive, it reminds me also of Frankenstein as well. So that's two little Frankenstein nuggets, I think. And then Bobby asks Shelley if Leo bought any new boots. Shelley tells him how he had to t she how he had her take them in for repair, and Bobby tells her rudely to go get the receipt.
There's a good streak of irony running throughout this episode in a few different scenes. Like you saw it at the beginning when Maddie is sitting down with Sarah and Leland, and the song by Louis Armstrong is playing, "It's a
Right.
Wonderful World." And obvious the irony is obviously there. I don't have to explain it, but there's irony here as well because Bobby's like pulling away from the we, just like you mentioned, and he's saying, "I'm missing economics right now." He's not missing economics. He's part of economics right now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because he's like going through Shelley's checkbook
That's
and,
hilarious.
you know, and he's figuring out that, like, he goes, well, from the looks of this, Leo never set foot into a bank, you know, and they're figuring out there's only $42 to stretch them out through the month and stuff like that. So I think there's very, this episode is, the word that springs to mind is like delicious because it's like you're eating it and you're tasting all these different flavors on your tongue and there's so much to see and I don't know, so much to unfold.
I had never caught that. That's hilarious. Anyway. So in Ben's office, a roaring fire blazes, and Audrey tells Ben that she knows everything about One-Eyed Jax. She tells him she was Prudence, and she learns from him that he has owned One-Eyed Jax for 5 years, that he knew Laura worked there, and that he slept with her.
What did we take from this scene? Dressed in flannel and recovering from heroin addiction, Audrey Horne is still hot.
Audrey asks if he killed Laura. He responds with, I loved her.
It's kind of a sad scene. It's sad for on a couple of different levels. You're sad for Ben Horne because he's sad, but it's also sad because he's a sick old man who was sleeping with a teenager. And you're sad because here's a daughter who couldn't get her dad's attention, but he was giving it all to somebody who was her age in an inappropriate
And
fashion.
then learning this nasty shit about your dad, I mean,
Yeah,
ugh.
yeah. Like,
That's probably the most sad. Really well acted by both of them.
yeah.
It's creepy that he has Laura's picture. I don't care. I don't know. If Paul had a kid, had a daughter, would there be any reason why you would feel comfortable to put a picture of his daughter on your desk?
The only way that would be acceptable is if she was part of a group picture that we were all in.
Yeah.
But if I was advanced in age and she was like an 18 or 19-year-old, you know, because I don't even want to go into like the 16, 17 thing. That's just creepy. But if she was an 18 or 19-year-old and I just had a picture of her, I'm sure he'd be the first one to have a big problem with it. You know what I mean? And it's just
Paul
like,
would.
yeah, he'd be like, dude, come on, what are you doing? We're talking about a guy who podcasts with us on some of the
Vikings.
other shows that
Yeah.
we cover. So, but yeah, that would just be that's not appropriate.
And you know Leland's seen that picture there.
Yeah, I mean, what does he think? I mean, he can't just put it down whenever Leland comes in dancing and singing.
I don't know.
Ugh.
At the Double R, this is, I really like this scene. Shelley tells Norma that she has to quit her job. And Shelley begins to cry, saying she does not want to let Norma down. And Norma tells her she will be fine, and when she is ready, she can come right back.
You look at you, we never meet Shelley's parents, okay? But you've got Bobby, who's her boyfriend, Leo, who's her husband, and Norma Jennings is the only person in this town who actually cares for Shelley.
Yeah.
She's the only person who really gives a crap about her, and it's a really touching scene. I
It makes me
actually
tear up.
I teared up too. You know, I
Yeah.
don't even know if I teared up the first or second time I watched this episode, but this time I did. It was, and I love their relationship. You know, it's
Yeah.
just a, it's a real mother and daughter thing, or at the very least, a big sister, little sister thing.
So Ed and Nadine arrive at the Double R. Norma quickly falls in line to pretend along with Ed for Nadine's sake. Nadine orders a chocolate milkshake and she tells Norma that she hopes that she is not mad for Ed taking her out. After receiving the shake, she shatters the glass between her palms. Norma and Shelley rush off to get first aid, and Nadine tells Ed that she could kiss him to death, and she kissed him with some heavy pressure, it seems.
I pictured this scene like behind the scenes, you know, with David Lynch directing it. Be like, all right, Everett, what I want you to do is have a facial expression like you've seen the craziest thing in the world. You know, of course, I'm saying David Lynch like he's Gordon Cole, but that's just how it struck me.
It's much that I like, I don't mind them as much in this scene or this
Yeah,
episode.
it's like when even the less than stellar subplots and themes that run through season two, when they're handled by Lynch and Frost, they become sublime. They become part of the Twin Peaks mainstream. It doesn't seem it like we said earlier, this episode could fit in anywhere in season one and be at home. I mean, obviously not continuity wise, but tone wise.
So now back at the Johnsons, Leo is visited by Bobby and Mike. Bobby shows Leo the boots from the repair shop, and Leo says again, new shoes. Bobby says, no, old shoes. And then Mike tells Bobby to get a hammer. They separate the sole from the boot and they discover a tape.
That I don't even think those tapes exist anymore.
I
Those
used to
little
have a
micro.
handheld tape recorder
Yeah.
because of Agent Dale
That's
Cooper.
right. Yeah. But you had it before I knew you, and you would walk around San Francisco, wouldn't you?
I don't know about that. I think I don't remember when I bought it. I don't remember the
I don't
or
remember you buying it when we were
I
together.
don't remember the origin, to
Yeah, I'm
be.
pretty sure you had it before we were together.
Yeah.
This scene is funny because Bobby's just like, quit spitting, man. Like it's something voluntary. There's a question that I had. Where is Hank Jennings?
Don't know.
Does he show up again? He does.
Yeah, he
So
does.
he somehow makes his way out of Jacques' custody, for lack of a
Well,
better term.
Jean Reno had
Or John, yeah.
Jean Reno. I don't know if he, I don't remember how, but we will see him again.
Okay, all right.
I don't remember how.
Does it seem strange that Norma's not worried about where he's at?
She's probably thinking good riddance. I hope he
Probably, yeah.
breaks parole and
Gets
gets
arrested and
arrested.
yeah, you're right. He's just conveniently off screen for several episodes.
Yeah.
There's also another potential continuity gaffe that I wanted to bring up, and I know it seems weird to bring up stuff like this after I've praised the episode so highly, but when Leo first comes home, Shelley and Bobby are going over the finances. I think it's a couple episodes back, and she's like, I had to quit my job, or I quit my job. And now she's back at the Double R, and she's telling Norma that she needs to quit her
Yeah,
job.
I've wondered about that. I guess that's what that is.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, no big deal. It definitely doesn't detract from my enjoyment of this episode, that's for sure.
Unless she had another job we didn't know about.
What could that have been?
Leo was probably making her work two jobs and keep the house clean.
Yeah, it was this other undisclosed job.
Yeah.
She worked at the single R across town, a less than reputable diner.
So Cooper is now talking to Diane at the sheriff's department. He's reporting what he has discovered from Laura's diary. Repeated mentioning of a man named Bob, a close friend of her father. Then another sentence stating that someday she will tell the world who Ben Horn really is. At that moment, Audrey walks in and tells him that her father was sleeping with Laura. Cooper says, "Holy smokes." And he might be like kind of he gets kind of like distracted or put off course here, it seems, because earlier he used the with 2 points of inquiry, come together, you should pay strict attention.
Right.
And I think he's doing the same thing, but it ends up distracting him away because he ends up going after Ben Horn when that's not the killer. Because
Right.
I think he found that sentence about Ben Horn on a completely different paper in the diary. It wasn't, in regard to the close friend of her father, the mentioning of the man named Bob.
That's a good point.
Is it?
I hadn't thought about it, but I mean, because you're talking about when he's talking about coincidences.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I took away from this scene, and I just developed this idea within the last half hour, so bear with me if it sounds a little bit crazy, but Do you think that there's a chance that Laura Palmer's spirit is directing some of the females in town that are, like, say, specifically Donna and Audrey, to kind of do things to try to right the wrongs that she helped create in her life, or to try to correct some of the negative situations that she was a part of? So she says, one day I'm going to tell the world about Ben Horn, and then in comes his daughter and does just that.
That's an interesting way to look at
There
it.
may not be much to it. I'm just going to say that right off the bat,
I
but
mean, her life and or end of her life has led to it.
yeah. And then
But
with Donna, you could say, she's been on this crazy crusade to try to figure out what happened and bring to light these facts. And as time has gone on, she's taken more and more of Laura's personality traits onto her. And we've given the real reasons why that might be, or the more obvious reasons, I should say, why that might be. But I don't know, it could fit in line with that theory. Write us, tell us what you think. Not you, the listeners. Stop writing.
Audrey also tells him that Laura worked at One Eye Jack's and that Ben Horn owns the place. Harry walks in at this point. Cooper tells her to not say a word to anyone, and she leaves. Cooper tells Harry about how Mike acted around Ben and that they need a warrant for Ben Horn. So now Ben is meeting with Mr. Tajimura. They're closing their deal together. The sheriff's department and Cooper arrive and arrest him. Harry says that Ben is wanted for questioning the murder of Laura Palmer. Ben tells them to go away. He says he's going to go out for a sandwich. They grab him and he resists like a child throwing a tantrum.
Ben Horn, it looks like Cleopatra ain't the only queen of denial.
Well, he
Sorry.
didn't do it.
Sorry, just had to do that. But he was in denial of the situation.
Yeah, he
You know what I
was. You're
mean? When
right.
it, because Cooper spelled it out for him, because he was like, if this is a sick joke, Cooper, I know people in high places. And he says,
He waved his finger too, like.
And he's like, you better do what they say.
So now back at the Palmers, the record player spins, but the song has ended. Sarah Palmer crawls her way down the stairs, calling for Leland. The overhead fan is on.
It's a Wonderful World, right, is the song. That
Song to
I mean,
her
that
own.
was the song that they were playing earlier, the
Yes.
last time we saw the
Yes.
record, and then we see it again, and
Yeah.
now it's over. Well, anyway, that life is coming to an end, so that's why we're at the skipping end of the record. Or not really skipping, but it's just what a vinyl record does at the end of its cycle.
Yeah, I was saying as we were watching it that I think, I mean, everybody says this about David Lynch, about him being a genius with, the visual medium, but also with sound. And the choice to have that in the background, it's symbolic, but it's also the sound of it. When you're playing records in your house and the song has ended, and for some reason, like, you're all the way on the other side of the house or something like that, and you can't get to it in time. It does have this weird, I don't even know what it's not disturbing, but it.
I think it's intended to do that because it's bad for the needle and it's not that great for the record to keep going like that. Well, actually, you're not playing it in the grooves anyway, so it's not bad for the record, but it's not good for the needle. So that sound is to let you know to take it off. But there's, I understand exactly what you're talking about, and he's using that soundscape to great effect because it keeps repeating over
Yeah.
and over and over, and it goes right back to what the giant says. It is happening again.
Again.
There's a theory, there's a theme
Wow.
rather, of repetition going on here, and I think that is the oral representation of that.
Yeah.
It's so he is a genius. It just keeps unraveling. This episode is just like a, it's like a little treasure box, and every time you open it, you see something new.
And visually, you have the record spinning, and then you have the overhead fan also
Ah,
spinning too.
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Then, so Ben's now brought into the sheriff's department, and he is brought down into the holding cell. The log lady is there, and she tells Cooper that we do not know what will happen or when, but there are owls at the roadhouse. Cooper says, "Something is happening, isn't it, Margaret?"
I have a little bit to say about this scene, but not a whole lot that really makes sense. Right here, that I'd rather just wait till we do
Okay,
feedback.
same here. Oh, feedback. Well, I'm
Yeah.
going to wait till we get to the roadhouse to say
Okay,
about the
yeah.
feedback.
Well, part of it's going to be in the roadhouse and part of it's going to be in feedback.
Okay. So now Pete is at home making himself a midnight mayo sandwich because Catherine's not there to make sure he's not eating mayo. So he thinks, because he's
So he
startled.
thinks,
Yeah,
yeah.
so he thinks. And he's startled by Mr. Tajimura. Mr. Tajimura begins to kiss him aggressively, hilariously. Catherine reveals herself, and it's awesome because Catherine's totally fucking with him.
Yeah.
It takes Pete a minute, and then he tells her she looks terrible, but he's very happy to see her.
And he breaks down, you know, and
Yeah.
he's very emotional. And Pete's a really good, loyal guy. I like him a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's put him through the ringer, but he's still happy to see her.
So back at the Palmers, Sarah crawls across the floor and she sees a vision of a white horse.
Okay, now you mentioned that.
Death rode came upon a white or a pale horse.
Yeah, is that a reference to?
Death came upon a pale horse. Let me look that up.
Now, is that a reference to one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse?
It's from Revelations.
Oh, it's from Revelations. Is the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Revelations, or is just
I
that
believe
not
so.
biblical at all?
Yeah, it's Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Okay, so because there's death, famine, pestilence, and time. No, time's not a four horsemen of the apocalypse. What is it?
Four Riders is seen as symbolizing conquest, war, famine, and death, respectively.
Oh, so war is one of them. Conquest.
Pale
Revelations, this
horse.
one. Okay, so
The
this is
let
a.
me just read about the pale horse real quick. The fourth and final horseman is named Death, known as the Pale Rider of all riders. He is the only one to whom the text itself explicitly gives a name. Unlike the other three, he is not described carrying a weapon or other object. Instead, he is followed by Hades, the resting place of the dead. However, illustrations commonly depict him carrying a scythe, like the Grim Reaper, or other implement. The color of Death's horse is written as Chloros in the original Koine Greek, which can mean either green, greenish yellow, or pale pallid. The color is often translated as pale, though ashen, pale green, and yellowish green are other possible interpretations. Based on uses of the word in ancient Greek medical literature, several scholars suggest that the color reflects the sickly pallor of a corpse. In some modern artistic depictions, the horse is distinctly green.
So if this could be seen as, I think it's a double meaning, just like everything in Twin Peaks has a double meaning. It's the pale horse, the horseman of, you know, death rides a pale horse, and it's also heroine riding the white horse, which we know Leland doses Sarah with whenever he's about to do something less than Lelandish and more
Yeah,
Bobbish.
some sort of opiate, yeah.
We don't know that it's heroin for sure, because we've is that the only time we see the white horse, or is there another time?
It's an Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah. Well, because white horse is a common symbolism, or you never seen the video for Skid Row's Wasted Time with the white horse in it?
I haven't.
It's definitive.
It's about
Heroin
heroin.
use, yeah. Heroin addicts.
It has been theorized that the horse is connected in some way to the White Lodge. It is possible that the horse is an embodiment of intoxication, the elephant in the room, or perhaps a spirit protector.
Intoxication is what I'd go with, because nobody's being protected in this scene.
Perhaps the most straightforward theory regarding the white horse is that it is a character foreshadowing death or impending danger. This equates to the white horse with the pale horse of death, one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse from the Bible. The Log Lady's intro to episode 206 features a poem along these lines. It's got, anyway, but the white horse is first seen during this episode by Sarah Palmer before Maddie Ferguson is killed by Leland Bob. And if I were to walk with me, Sarah sees the white horse the night before Laura dies.
I'm going with the duality. I think it's the pale horse, and I think it's also the white horse of opiate.
Yeah, it could, I
You
mean, there's
know?
dualities all over Twin Peaks. Why not?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm going with.
Sounds good. Okay. So now Donna meets with James at the Roadhouse. She asks if he has heard about Harold Smith. He says yes, but it is not her fault. She says he did not deserve to die. Donna sees the sheriff and company arrive, and she announces that. And before I go into that, I just want to say about Donna's character. I really like that she cared for Harold.
Yeah.
You know, that she had to, because James just kind of blew it off that he killed himself, and she seemed deeply wounded by this.
James is pretty callous about it. He's just kind of like, well, he did that. He's very, you know, and I don't know if that's bitterness that derives from the condition of his mother or what's going on with that, but he's very indifferent and callous about Harold's state, and he says, well, he chose to do that. That's the path he took, and that's what happened to you or happens to you when you do that. Whereas Donna is, I think she feels a certain amount of responsibility for what's gone on because he didn't kill himself before he met her,
Right.
and you know, they did a lot of stuff to really upset his balance. There's a very delicate balance, the orchid's curse. They, you know what I mean? They upset the moisture in his environment in a very significant way.
Well, and also she mentioned how he was hurting inside, and then James
Yeah.
had to be like, "We're
Yeah.
all hurting inside.
Yeah,
Let me turn
James
this spotlight on me now."
he had to put the brakes on that because in Twin Peaks, the only person that hurts inside is James Hurley. That's how that works. He's the only tortured soul in that town.
So, like I said, Donna sees the sheriff and company arrive. Harry Cooper and the log lady sit at a table. James tells Donna that Maddie is leaving, and Maddie actually hadn't said anything to Donna. Do you have any thoughts as to why?
Don't really have too many thoughts as to why, but I kind of see her jealousy creeping up again. Like, oh, well, she talked to you to tell you she was leaving, but this is news to me. So
It
she
just
still
makes me
has.
think more about Maddie, not so much about what Donna's thinking about it. If maybe Maddie just felt it was best to,
I think maybe after everything that had happened, she maybe felt more comfortable just saying it to James, knowing that Donna would find out that way. Maybe it would be like too hard to take for her to leave, because she's not only leaving Uncle Leland and Aunt Sarah, she's leaving her friends that she made, and they're going to feel a loss by her absence. And sometimes it's better just to go than it is to like explain to somebody why you're leaving.
It's true. The log lady munches on peanuts. She's pretty ravenous. Cooper's watching her eat. Donna mouths the chorus of the song to James, rocking back inside my heart.
Which is head and shoulders above, just you and I.
Well, yes.
Yeah, this is a much better song for them to kind of come together by.
That's also very sweet.
It is. I thought it was sweet.
Very sweet before it turns really terrible. Harry Coop and the log lady watch the stage. After some time has passed, Cooper is watching the stage still, and the musicians then disappear, and the giant is there in their place, and he says, "It is happening again, twice."
I definitely want to talk about this, but we're close to feedback as it is,
We'll wait.
so we'll just wait for feedback. But I was just going to say, Em and I went to a convention, a Comic-Con, and we saw Carl Struycken, the guy who plays the giant, and he signed a 8x10 for us of him and Cooper on it, and he wrote, "It's happening again."
Right before we recorded
Right
this
before we
episode.
recorded this episode, we're recording this episode. By the way, there's a full moon in this episode, and there is a full moon tonight.
Weird.
That's awesome. But so anyway, back to the episode. He says it's happening again twice, just like you pointed out.
Cooper looks worried.
Yeah, because Cooper knows he's a strong receiver, so he understands what's going on.
Back with Leland, we see that his reflection reveals that he is Bob. He puts on his gloves, and I imagine that if you're, if I don't, rem a lot of times I don't remember what it's like to watch this with fresh eyes, but you might think that he's about to kill Sarah
Yeah, it's
because
definitely
Sarah's on
possible.
the floor right behind him. But Maddie comes down the stairs complaining of a burning smell, and we see that she's going to be the victim pretty quickly here. Because she first finds Sarah and then she begins to run back up the stairs. He charges for her and brings her back into the living room. We see him switch from Bob to Leland. It's horrible to watch.
There's a tug of war going on in this scene, and I didn't realize it until this viewing, which is probably my third viewing of this episode over a span of however many years. But there's a serious tug of war going on, and Bob is actually having to exert control over Leland's body towards the end of it. It goes back and forth a little bit, but when he finally ends up killing her, he really has to just kind of, because he has, I don't want to get too far ahead, but he has Maddie and he's holding her and he's saying, "Laura, Laura." And then
Then he throws his head back, and there's this light that shines right above his face, and that's when he takes over full control.
Right. So this kind of goes like makes me think back to all of the other times when we're kind of speculating whether or not it was Leland or it was Bob. And I don't think it was either way consistently. I think that there was times where there was Leland and there was times when there was Bob, and they're going back and forth and trying to fight for control of this vessel.
Did you notice Leland's facial expression when he became Bob? Like he had more of this
Yes.
villainous look to his
Yeah.
face.
He looked it was sinister and
His eyebrows were, it had that villain cartoon
yeah, he became a predator.
arch.
He became a predator, and he was just a normal person, and then he just became that look. Like, and you see that later on when you see the scenes of Ray Wise playing whoever it is in the Black Lodge.
The punches are brutal.
Oh man.
And the emotives, the sounds that he makes, Leland makes, are, I mean, obviously she's sounding terrible, but it's just really really sad, but it's just really hard to watch because it's very brutal.
It's very difficult to watch, but it's also just as difficult to turn away. I can't stop watching it once I'm watching it. My eyes are glued to the screen and I'm not liking what I'm seeing, but I'm loving it at the same time. If that I know it's a contradiction, it's a paradox, but it's a masterfully done scene and it's a great piece of cinematography. But I can see from just a sort of pedestrian viewer's perspective how that could turn them off from this show. I think there, looking back, there might have been a lot of people who dropped the show after seeing this because they just thought it was maybe too much for them. Because it was almost movie-like in its
Yeah,
brutality.
it was.
Like you expect to see that in a full-length feature, not in a TV show.
So Leland calls her Laura, and then he kills her after he transforms completely into Bob. And he says, Leland says you're going back to Missoula, Montana. And he slams her face into that painting. And then after she's unconscious or dead on the floor, he puts a letter under her fingernail.
The scene is it's like grinding of gears because you go from scenes earlier in the episode where there's this very lighthearted humor, like at the Double R with Norma, and Big Ed and Nadine and everything, and then you get to this, and this is just lacking humor in an abject sense. There's no, it's
Like
hard to
two
put,
different shows.
yeah, it's hard to put into words, but it's just. I've seen action movies and I've seen horror movies that contain less brutality than this scene contains to me. It's just so harsh. And because of who this person is supposed to be to her and how much we like her as a character, and just to see this all happening, it's sad. But it's so well done at the same time.
So the giant looks at Cooper with sadness. Then Julie Cruise and her band are back. And Cooper, before we see Julie Cruise and her band come back, Cooper brings his hand up to like his tie or his heart, and he has this look of, I think, failure, because he knows it is happening again. And if he'd only like continued to listen to these denizens instead of listening to the people of Twin Peaks, he would have maybe been directed to where he needed to go.
I don't think it was just sadness in the giant's look. I think there was also a certain amount of recrimination towards Cooper.
Cooper,
Yeah, I think he was looking at him
blaming him.
like he said it is happening again twice, and then his look said the rest of it. And it was kind of like, why are you still sitting here? Why aren't you doing something to try to prevent this, to try to stop it? I've given you every clue I can give you. I've done everything within the limitations of what I'm allowed to do as a denizen of the lodge, or at least that's what I'm assuming.
You failed.
And you failed. And I see there is a sadness in his eyes for sure, but I think there's also an accusation that he could have been better and he could have been more proactive.
We see the elderly waiter from the Great Northern. He's there, and he approaches Cooper and says consolingly that he is so sorry. Bobby is also there, and he has tears running down his cheeks. Donna begins to cry inexplicably. The scene ends, and the episode ends with a concerned look on Cooper's face, and it fades to red curtains. One thing I would say about Bobby, Dana Ashbrook was just ran in to pick up something off of set. He wasn't actually scheduled to be in this episode or in that particular scene. But David
Oh.
Lynch was like, hey, go ahead and get into your, costume or whatever, and just go up there and start looking sad.
He did a
And
great job.
so, well, I
Yeah.
mean, it's a nice touch, to have just not just Donna also feeling, but Bobby, he was also another person who was connected to Laura.
Yeah. I mean, he did a great job for just being on the cuff like that, or off the cuff rather. Like, hey, just go over to the bar and act sad, and damn.
That's his job.
Yeah, that's his job, I guess. You're either good at your job or you're not, and he is, so.
It's like James, though, is not affected. And I mean, he's all talking about how we all are hurting inside, but he's not. Even though Donna and Bobby were connected to Laura, and you would think James was too because they had a relationship, but for some reason, he's not moved by whatever is moving Bobby and Donna. It's because he's so self-involved.
He's very self-involved. He's a narcissist to a certain extent, and I think that he welcomes with open arms situations which can within which he's hurt emotionally. Therefore, he can assume the role that he wants to play, which is the tortured, damaged soul,
That's twisted.
and that's how that's him,
Huh.
though. I mean, that's how I see him. That's why he comes up with that really sorrowful and, morose, crappy music that he comes up with.
So, anything about why it ends with Cooper's face and then fading to red curtains?
It's a nod towards the denizens of the lodge, I would say. Obviously, that's not any kind of insightful tidbit. It's just, I think it's an obvious thing, but
I just,
it's a little bit of a teaser
that's, yeah.
because when you see the red curtains come down, you're like, oh, cool, we're gonna get one of these little like after scenes where you'd wow, Bob, wow, but nothing like that happens. You just roll the credits.
I think this is meant as a reminder, like.
Because that influence in Twin Peaks becomes more and more and more
There's
as the
still more to
season goes on.
reveal, even though we just revealed the killer of Laura Palmer. Let's
Yeah.
show them some red curtains. Like, there's still more mystery to be had. Anything else before we go into feedback?
I just want to say the scene with Donna and James when he comes over to comfort her and she's crying. Everybody in there they feel I think you've already covered this, but this is just my two cents on it. They understand that something bad has really happened, or something really bad has just happened, but they don't know what, and it just kind of affects them like a pall has fallen over the whole town. It's kind of like a really thick fog rolling in or something, like an emotional fog.
Oh, so we got feedback from Daniel, and he says, "Hey, Stephen M., this episode is one of the very best, masterfully directed, full of emotion, and truly chilling. It uses some of the most effective horror to convey the sadly pedestrian, everyday garden variety horror of domestic abuse that goes on in far too many homes, while at the same time not sidelining the supernatural mythology that I love. Because of the way the show insists on having each episode be a separate day, it does feel silly how it opens with Mike repeating the same lines he said at the end of the last episode while the police all just look on and sip coffee. It's like, why didn't they go to the Great Northern that night? It seems like he's just been repeating it over and over all night, waiting for them to do something about it."
I think this is, I don't think that this particular scene, I understand exactly what you're saying, Daniel, with this. It seems weird because every day is represented by an episode. So why the hell, would he just, they're all standing there drinking their morning coffee. It's obviously the morning after. So it's like, has Philip Gerard as Mike been like spouting off at the mouth all night and they're just tolerating it? I mean, I don't know, but I think, this seems like a network decision. This seems like a higher up executive producer type thing where they go, okay, what you're going to need to do is come in because the audience is stupid and they've been at work all week or they've been at school all week since they saw the last episode and they're not going to rewatch the last episode before they watch this one. So we need to put them back in that headspace. So go right back to that same scene and rehash it so we can start the episode with how we ended it, which is bogus and it's BS, but I think that's how they did TV back then because they had less faith in the viewer, linking the episodes cognitively in some sort of order.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. But I would rather think that maybe they were up till dawn, and just
Yeah.
before dawn broke is when they got this information. So
And
that's
maybe
how I'm
there
gonna
was,
do my little revisionist history about that.
and to add to that, maybe there was, because Harry says, okay, he kind of comes in and gives the A-OK that everything's been finalized. So maybe we could look at it as their last conversation with Philip Gerard slash Mike was very late at night, and this is very early in the morning because Hawk hasn't finished his goddamn coffee yet. So he's not about to go do Harry's bidding.
How long does it take to get a warrant? Maybe that's why.
Yeah, maybe they had to get the warrant. And yeah, because they did show up and put
Well,
Ben Horn under
Harry
arrest.
says they have a warrant.
Yeah, so that could be the explanation.
And so back with Daniel, he says, "One interesting tidbit from the original script reveals that Harold was another patient of Dr. Jacoby's."
That would go a long way to explain why he's not any closer to being a functioning member of society, because I wouldn't go see Dr. Jacoby if my life depended on it. But that's just me. Maybe I'm being harsh. I wonder why they left that out. I mean, does Dr. Jacoby come back?
Yes.
But it's not till later on.
Right.
So,
I believe he comes back.
how many psychiatrists or psychologists are there going to be in a town the size of Twin Peaks at any rate?
Well, I know like he was also supposed to be the third person that we were supposed to suspect as the killer, so maybe that's why they were had that in the script, but they decided not to put so much emphasis on him.
Yeah. Because our big red herring ends up being Ben Horn
Right.
right before the reveal.
So speaking of, Daniel continues with the scene with Ben furiously puffing away on his cigar reminds me that perhaps it's the fire that's the key to the symbolic use of smoking in the show. Not just recklessness, but a general sign of the dark side. Playing with fire, fire walk with me, the burning smell, etc. The first time we see Leland and Ben in the pilot, they are flanking a fireplace. And Wild at Heart, there are repeated shots of a match being lit, and in Blue Velvet, it's a roaring candle.
I came up with the idea that people who smoke in this series and people who've listened to this whole thing have probably heard me spout off at the mouth about it before, that people who are smoking, it's a sign of their recklessness. And it carried for a number of episodes, but I think Daniel's theory about the fire is probably a lot more accurate. I think that's probably it because it makes a lot of sense. It fits with everything we've seen, and Donna smokes in this episode, but she doesn't do anything stupid because she's smoking at the Roadhouse. And
It's
she
playing with
puts.
fire, which is reckless. I mean,
Okay,
I think it could go.
yeah. I mean, I guess if you're saying, are we both right? But I mean, I kudos to Daniel for coming out with this because that it does make more sense. There is a lot of symbolism with fire in David Lynch's work overall, and specifically in Twin Peaks. So I think that's, like I said, I think that's more accurate.
So on with Daniel again, he says, Ben Horn is such a good red herring because it pays off the sense that Laura's life harbored the dark secrets of the whole town. You may recall Lynch and Frost once tried to make a biopic of Marilyn Monroe and how her relationship with the Kennedy brothers might have led to her death, and this would have been called Goddess. But this easier answer does not interest Lynch, who, since the very beginning, has deliberately injected a visual kind of terror into the Palmer home. Laura's terrible secret was incestuous rape, and the thematic center of the show is therefore a town that knew something was deeply wrong, but now seeks to repress their guilt over their own ignorance and inaction. Yeah, the fact that everybody was ignoring the fact that Ben Horn had Laura's picture on his desk, something's up.
We covered some of this. Some of my answer to this got covered when we talked about the picture earlier on, and I know you have a little bit more to add to it at this point, or maybe not. But yeah, I agree completely. It's it just gets into this creepy territory that I just don't even. Man, when people trust other people and they betray that trust in that kind of way and to take advantage of them, it's one of the most vile things that humans can do to each other, and I feel like I could say more, but it would just sound like I'm reiterating a point I've already made.
So he says, do you think Sarah knows what Leland is going to do and is feebly trying to stop it from happening again? I think she has a sense. I don't think she's, because you can, even your unconscious, I think, maybe some part of you is aware of what's going on around you.
Yeah.
And, she might even hear that fan turn on and her heart starts to quicken or something like that. I think she, some part of her knows, yes.
I think she definitely knows. I think that something clicked in her, like whenever the incest was going on before Fire Walk With Me, or up until Fire Walk With Me, I guess you could say, she was able to suppress it as kind of a mic, like a microcosm of what the town has been doing. You know what I mean? She probably knows that something is off, but she's just keeping it under the water. And once her daughter died, something clicked in her head. And now she knows, and that's why she's been like seeing Bob and seeing all this other stuff. So she knew that Leland slash Bob was going to be doing something, and he knew that she knew. That's why she had to be drugged, and she was crawling down the steps because she was fighting desperately against, the opiate fog that she was in to try to stop something, but she was just ineffectual because you're drugged. What can you do?
I don't think she ever knew in conscious though. Like, I don't ever, whenever she was conscious, I don't think she knew that Leland was capable of that.
So you don't think she maybe had like some inkling of it that wasn't.
I think she probably had this really loud noise, like that would be in her mind. I mean, it's hard to explain. I think she, a part of her knew, but she, it wasn't a formed thought in her mind that she could actually accuse him of something.
Yeah.
So, And the reason why he would drug her is just to prevent her from ever encountering the act.
Right. Or just to not even hear it at all, because, you know, I know there's the white horse and everything, but it kind of, there's a little bit of a hole there if it's going to be heroin, because she says in Fire Walk With Me, he's been having me since I was 12. She's 18 years old at this point. So that's 6 years. If you're consistently giving somebody heroin that whole time, they're going to be addicted to it. So she's going to have withdrawals if she doesn't have it. She's going to know at some point.
Yeah, I don't
So
know.
that's I that kind of has to go out the window. But
Laura was 17,
oh,
also.
17. So that's still 5 years. But even if it
Yeah.
was 1 year and you're doing it consistently throughout the year, but then the same thing could be said for any kind of drug that would knock you out like that.
Yeah, it's just probably one of those things they didn't think too deeply
Yeah,
about.
you're right.
So now back to Daniel. He says, so the log lady leads Cooper to the roadhouse because owls are there. When the giant appears, Cooper checks for his ring, only to realize, as a deep sadness seems to wash over the room, that he has failed. He knows from Laura's diary how she was sexually abused from an early age by Bob, who she calls a friend of her father's. So if the owls wouldn't have lured Cooper away to the roadhouse through Margaret, the next logical place to go would be the Palmers to ask Leland some hard questions, thus possibly catching him in the act and saving Maddie's life, right? So is the giant really as positive a force as he had seemed, getting Cooper away from the very crime he is foretelling? So this is the opposite of what I thought. Like you said, the giant was being recriminating towards him
Yeah.
because Cooper was taking off track because he was listening to people like Audrey and Laura's diary and picking a random sentence that might not have had anything to do with the sentences that had to do with Bob, you know?
Yeah, okay.
And so instead of going to the Great Northern when Mike first said that he's at the Great Northern, that's where he first failed. And then he goes the next morning, Leland's no longer there, and he's back to this, I think, trusting something that's actually not always working. It's not it sometimes works for him, I guess, the coincidences, but it's not working here. Because when Mike grabs his arm and falls over and Ben walks into the room, those are coincidences.
Yeah.
Or it could be maybe because Ben had been around Leland. I don't know why Bob or Mike acted like that when Ben walked into the room.
That scene happened before we got the big reveal that Leland was actually the killer, though, so it could have been part of the red herring scheme.
Right. But if you were to try to give an actual explanation other than red herring, there's two there that it could be either because he was close to Leland or it's just a coincidence. But anyway, he continues to get distracted, and instead of actually just he has these owls. Owls are not what they seem. That's why you have the host with the inhabitant inside. So the host is not what it seems. That's why I believe the giant's an owl as well. If he would just listen to the owls and not be so pragmatic about it, he would have caught Leland sooner.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with what you're saying. I think that, you know, but that's to disagree with Daniel though, because I don't think that the giant is a, I think he is a benevolent force. I think he's on Cooper's side. Whereas I think Daniel seems to kind of call that into question.
Do you, because you were disagreeing earlier about the whole owls thing, so do you still not believe?
Yeah, whenever you say the owls, okay, when we first get introduced to the concept of the owls not being what they seemed, the heavy, obvious implication is that they are malicious entities that are trying to misdirect you. Or they are trying to deceive you, or they're trying to do some sort of ill will towards you. So if we were to consider every inhabitant of the lodge, good, bad, or otherwise, to be an owl, like you said, kind of like the Russian doll, you know what I mean? You have the person with the,
The
they're the
vessel doll.
vessel, and there's the, you know, the spirit inhabits them and so forth. Then it makes more sense because then you have a wide array. So when you say owls, you could mean anywhere on the spectrum from good to bad. So if it's the owls that brought Cooper there when he could have been at Leland's house, you know, taking care of business and making sure that Maddie stayed, you know, alive and healthy, which he doesn't even really know about at this point. But I think that if there's any owls exerting a bad influence, it's the ones that got Margaret to go to the police station and tell Cooper what was going on. We need to go to the roadhouse, which is the opposite direction of where he needed to go to stop a crime.
Well, what makes anybody think that Cooper was going to go to Leland's anyway? Because he was convinced he already had the killer.
That's a good point. That is a good point.
Is he going to go to gather more evidence?
Yeah, if they thought they already had Leland, if their spotlight is on
Ben.
Leland, I'm sorry, if their spotlight is on Ben, if Benjamin Horne is in their crosshairs, he's not going to go to the Palmer household anyway. It's just not going to happen. So it's kind of, I guess it's a little bit far-fetched to think that he would have made those cognitive leaps anyway.
So, yeah, Daniel, I agree with most of the things you say, but not
It's the
that
rare instance that we disagree.
one. Yeah.
And plus, it's just the look in the giant's eyes when he's saying it's happening again. I don't see anything else in there but this desire to help him be doing the right thing.
Yeah, and he's accusing and he's sad.
Yeah.
Okay, so Daniel says this is his last point. He says, isn't it weird that there isn't a single instance where Cooper has ever directly interacted with Maddie on screen? Especially when back in episode 3, the little man expressly said in Cooper's dream, she is my cousin, but doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer? Which directly preceded the episode where Maddie first arrived for the funeral. Maddie has had visions of the blood stain on the carpet and Bob coming for her at the Haywards, which Sarah even called to tell Cooper about off screen. Yet he never once talks to her or brings up that she could be in danger. It is weird. You would think he would immediately be talking to her.
Yeah, I never thought about it until Daniel brought up that point, but they don't share any screen time. They never meet each other. There's not even any nods towards them, like having any kind of talking or truck with each other off screen. I wonder why. I
Maybe
get.
because he thought, well, she just arrived from Missoula, Montana. What the hell could she know?
Yeah,
But
a
if she's.
relative who arrives after the death, for the funeral, I mean, you don't
Yeah.
really put them in the suspect camp right away.
But once again, he's not listening to these beings from this other world. If he had, he would have talked to Maddie. He's not listening.
Yeah, he's being a little bit dense.
For as smart as he is.
Yeah. But I mean, Cooper's a smart guy and he's relying on the things that he knows will solve crimes. And I mean, you got to give him some credit because he's taking this stuff at face value and he's actually integrating it to a certain degree in his
Right.
sleuthing techniques, where I think a lot of people would just go, this is just some crazy dream I had. I'm not even going to consider that when it comes to trying to figure out this crime. But Cooper's folding it in, but he's just not doing it full measure and making it successful, which is a shame because Maddie could still be alive.
So I don't know how to express what's going on or what I think is going on with Cooper engaging with this information. It makes me think of like those three blind men who her grasping at an elephant. One's got the trunk and he's like, it's a snake. And the other one's got the leg and it's a tree. And I don't
Yeah.
remember the other part, but he has like a part of it and he understands a little bit of it, but the whole picture he doesn't fully understand.
But I don't want to
But
come
he has
down.
more than anybody
Yeah,
else.
I don't want to come down too hard on Cooper because of this, because I feel, and I'm not saying you are, I'm just saying that he's doing the best he can. I mean, I try to think about how I would deal with something like that if I was, to take some sort of psychic, like things that I have received from someplace else that even if I had full confidence, which he does, that this is very real, how would you integrate it into your life? How would you make it useful information and kind of put it out there and act upon it? That would be a difficult thing to process and do.
He should probably write it all down and just have a board with, I don't know. I think that is a major oversight about she's my cousin, but doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer? Why did he not ever engage with her? I think that's a very good question. It's a huge oversight.
And the little man is saying, the arm is saying, she is my cousin. So what does that tell us? Because it's actually Laura's cousin, not his.
It's just they it's not his cousin. It's just a weird way they communicate.
I don't know. It seems like there'd be something more to that.
I don't know. I just get the it's just it this came before we met Maddie, that statement. And is Laura's cousin. It's weird dream speak. I don't know how else to explain this. I just don't think it there's any I don't think it has anything to do with the little man except that he's trying to communicate the best he can with a human.
Or maybe he's not saying Maddie's his cousin. Maybe he's saying Laura's his cousin.
But Laura looks almost exactly like Laura Palmer.
Yeah, I guess he would be saying that Maddie is his cousin. She is my cousin, but doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer? I feel like sometimes trying to figure out what Lynch and Frost have done with some of this stuff is like putting a really complicated jigsaw puzzle together when every single piece on the board is the same color and the pieces are super small.
And they're also misshapen.
Exactly. And they don't quite fit.
Yeah.
Like, this piece doesn't fit anywhere else on this board, but this is the closest place that it's going to fit. But you know, it really doesn't fit there. But where the fuck else are you going to put it?
Yep.
That's what you get left with. But that's what keeps drawing us back to Twin Peaks over and over. It made us want to do a podcast on it. It makes us, celebrate it as fans, is because eventually, sometimes when you work hard enough and you think hard enough, and you get really good feedback, thank you, Daniel, you can make some of these pieces fit. So it's worth it for the times that we succeed and, the times that we fail. We just kind of go, well, there's always next episode.
Actually, Daniel and I had a good conversation on Facebook about what they're going to do without Frank Silva in 2016. If you guys have any thoughts on that, write to us at noship.net. Also, if you have any feedback just about what we're covering right now, please write to us and contribute along with Daniel.
Yeah, and FYI, when we talked to Carl Struycken, the giant, he also said that he had not been contacted as of yet. This was on Saturday the 28th of February, that he hadn't been contacted by anybody to do, the third season of Twin Peaks. So that's kind of interesting. There's still time, but
Yeah, and if you want to see our picture that we took with Carl Sorkin, you can go to our Facebook page or our Twitter page, and you can get to those by going to our No Ship Network at Twitter or at No Ship Network Facebook, or you can go to our website, go to our contact page, and you can be linked up to our Facebook or Twitter there. Okay, that's it for now. I am your host, Em.
now, I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.